From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To The Point.
Two security breaches in 2 weeks. Just embarrassing or something more? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Highly publicized blunders have raised questions about security at the White House and at airport checkpoints nationwide. If the Salahis could crash the party, were the Obamas and their guests at risk? When the TSA put the manual online, did would-be terrorists learn anything new? The president has ordered government agencies to be more transparent. Will that new openness lead to future mistakes that erode public safety? On Reporter's Notebook later on, American evangelists and gay bashing in Africa. First, here's the news.
Support for To The Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Hello again, Warren Alney back with To The Point. When party crashers get into the White House and an airport screening manual goes online, are Americans and their leaders not so safe after all? If the president is perceived to be weak on security, what's the political fallout? On Reporter's Notebook, American evangelical Rick Warren has denounced a death penalty sentence for gays proposed in Uganda. Will that make a difference there? First, this news update. In Brussels today, the European Union pledged $3 billion for the so-called Fast Start Fund to help poor nations threatened by global warming. The hope is to improve chances for an agreement at the climate change conference in Copenhagen. Darren Samuelson is in Copenhagen for Environment and Energy Daily. And Darren, it's good to have you back on our program.
Good evening from Copenhagen.
So $3 billion starting next year, a total of $9 billion pledged by the EU. How's that going down so far in Copenhagen? Have they heard about it?
Yeah, they have. There's a mixed response. I just stepped out of a press conference that was from the G77, the group of 77, which are some of the poorest countries in the world, the developing countries of the world. And the head of that, the speaker representing the Sudanese government, actually said it was quite weak and wants orders of magnitude more, hundreds of billions of dollars from the rest of the world, from the world's wealthiest countries to cough up to deal with climate change. Spelled out all of the reasons why, whether it be, you know, dealing with rising seas or drought, famine. So they're kind of looking for orders of magnitude more money than what the Europeans have just proposed.
Is there any question that if global warming is as it has been portrayed, it will cost hundreds of billions of dollars?
That's absolutely right. I mean, that's the estimates you see from the World Bank, the United Nations here talking about, you know, asking for about $100 billion a year per year over the course of the next many decades to help countries deal with, you know, adaptation to climate change, also to help them work on deforestation efforts, trying to figure out what methodologies to be using to try and keep trees standing, and then also to help deploy clean energy technologies from the rich countries to the poor countries. So combination of those three things is seen as a way to help the developing country, you know, do its part to reduce emissions.
Now, part of what was, or the people who did the announcement in Brussels included the Prime Minister of Great Britain and the President of France. They are, as you pointed out, orders of magnitude lower than what the developing countries want. What then are the chances for an agreement?
Well, I mean, this is one of the many key pieces to an agreement that they hope to reach in Copenhagen. We're about the midway point, the first week of the talks. You know, these talks do go into the evenings, and we're looking at talks on Saturday. The environmental ministers actually will start arriving. So the top-level ministers from about 190 countries will be arriving here in Copenhagen tonight, tomorrow. Some of them have already been here, the head of the Chinese negotiation team, and then President Obama's lead climate diplomat arrived on Wednesday, Todd Stern. And so, you know, they're working right now through a number of different proposals. There's been at least, from my count, about 7 or 8 different ideas for how to advance the next international agreement in Copenhagen. President Obama will be here on Friday, one of about 110 world leaders, which is just going to take this up, you know, a level of magnitude higher in terms of world attention on this issue.
By comparison to the EU's pledge today of $3 billion right away and $9 billion over the next 3 years, have the U.S. and China made any pledges directly of direct money to the developing nations?
Yeah, President Obama about 2 weeks ago said that he would put forward his share of the $10 billion commitment over the course of 3 years. He didn't give a number, but you can clearly see in the House and Senate, for the United States, this is money that's going to come out of the regular appropriations process. And the House passed an appropriations bill that is now in the Senate, and I think they want to try and pass it this weekend, has about $1.2 billion that would go toward these issues of adaptation, deforestation, and technology. It's about $600 million more than the last budget that was approved during the Bush administration. So, Obama will have about $1.2 billion to bring to the table, which is about half of what the Europeans are proposing. And then looking forward to the next two fiscal years, Senator Kerry just the other day sent a letter to the to Secretary Clinton, the Secretary of State, urging her to request for the FY11 budget $3 billion. Now, that'll be the Obama budget, which then goes into the meat grinder of the congressional appropriations process. And that money is going to have to come out of, a foreign affairs budget where there's other competing priorities. Malaria and AIDS were two that Senator Judd Gregg, the New Hampshire Republican, is the top Republican on that Appropriations Committee, told me, are competing with that. I talked to him just the other day in the Capitol before I left Washington.
And then China, as I understand, a major polluter that it is, the biggest of all, wants money and doesn't want to give money away. Is that correct?
That's right. We got an interesting tit-for-tat happening here on that one. The Chinese want money, and Todd Stern, the American negotiator, the other day here in Copenhagen, said the Chinese were very unlikely to get their share of get any share of the $10 billion, given the fact that we owe the Chinese quite a big amount of money ourselves. And he said that he wants to steer the money, if it's possible, to the least developed countries, to the poorest countries. It's going to be hard to do that, though.
Darren Samuelson, once again, a senior reporter for Environment and Energy Daily, speaking to us from Copenhagen. Many thanks for being on our program.
Happy to do it.
In a moment, two security breaches in 2 weeks. Just an embarrassment or something more? On To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman, I'll be back with To the Point. The Secret Service is still trying to explain how Tarek and Michelle Salahi got past White House security and into the Obama's state dinner for the Prime Minister of India. The Transportation Security Administration has been stung by senatorial criticism. Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine calls it a shocking breach by the TSA that has effectively given al-Qaeda and every other terrorist group a textbook for evading airport security. The TSA says what improper went online was in fact outdated, unclassified information, not the everyday screening manual used at airport checkpoints. Patrick Smith is an airline pilot who writes the Ask the Pilot column for Salon.com, also has a book by the same name. Patrick Smith, good to have you back on our program.
Thanks for having me.
How would you mediate this dispute between Senator Collins and the TSA? Was this a big deal or not?
Well, what I take away from this quote-unquote scandal was virtually nothing other than a feeling of extreme annoyance over the fact that after all the things that TSA and airport security get wrong, that this is the best that, the media and politicians can rouse themselves to be shocked about. I mean, we're reading headlines like, leaked TSA guidelines reveal confidential secrets. I mean, a better headline is maybe billions of dollars wasted every year in pointless TSA screening methods to begin with. I mean, TSA is wrong on so many levels. This really is a nothing issue.
Wouldn't it be an important issue if, in fact, the operating manual for airport screening went online?
Not if airport screening is basically pointless to start with, no. I mean, we have to circle this a little bit and realize that there are two fundamental flaws in TSA's screening philosophy. The first one is that it considers everybody who flies, young and old, domestic and foreign, pilot and passenger, to be a potential terrorist. The second is this ridiculous fixation with the tactics used by the September 11th terrorists rather than and the subsequent fixation with weapons themselves, you know, sharp objects, knives, you know, rather than the people who might use these objects. TSA refuses to acknowledge that the success of the 2001 attacks, ready for this now, had nothing to do with the hijackers' ability to sneak weapons past airport security. Even a child knows that you can make a dangerous sharp object out of anything. The attackers were not exploiting a weakness in airport security. They were exploiting a weakness in our mindset, that is, our expectations of what hijackings were based on numerous earlier incidents. Now, the element of surprise, not box cutters, in other words, is what took control of those aircraft. And even before the first of the Twin Towers fell to the ground, that element of surprise and the box cutters that went with it were no longer a useful tool. Paradigm over. But TSA will not realize that, and they have assembled what is basically this impossible and unsustainable task, which is that of keeping any and all quote-unquote weapons, whether it's a hobby knife or hair gel, out of the hands of 2 million people every day of the year. I mean, prison guards can't even keep drugs and knives out of maximum security prisons, and TSA is supposed to, you know, root out butter knives at overcrowded airports. It's completely preposterous.
Patrick Smith, again, a writer of Ask the Pilot. He himself, an airline pilot, the column in Salon magazine. Brian Jenkins is an independent security expert, senior advisor to the president of RAND, the policy research organization. His most recent book is Will Terrorists Go Nuclear? In 1996, he served as a member of the White House Commission on Aviation Safety and Security. Brian Jenkins, it's always good to have you on our program.
Thank you.
Is Patrick Smith right? Is the TSA wasting billions of dollars getting people to take off their shoes when they really ought to be focused on something else?
I don't know that it's TSA's choice to be wasting money that way. The fact is that it is Congress and, in fact, the public itself that demands that we conduct security in this inefficient fashion. The fact is, Mr. Smith is correct that TSA rules now consider everyone to be a potential hijacker, and that the focus is on weapons, not on people. And that is because the American public basically want their security to be passive. They don't want it to be intrusive. They don't want to give up information. They don't want a more selective process to take place. They want their security to be egalitarian, to apply exactly the same way to everyone.
Aren't people pretty annoyed, though, at the necessity of take the, you know, the little old lady who has to take off the shoes, the children who have to be have their suitcases opened up? Isn't that regarded as excessively intrusive by most passengers?
You know, it is, and indeed, when something like that happens, where an individual is selected for a secondary inspection, then both that individual and the other people become more apprehensive and angry about it. There's a herding instinct here as well. But let me go back to where you started this discussion, and that is on the effects of this security breach.
Okay.
Let's take Mr. Smith's position as a correct one, that there are better ways to apply security. One better way to apply security is to have a system that focuses more on people and indeed is more selective. That is, it focuses more on some people and less on other people. In order to manage that system, that means that TSA does have to be able to control and also protect information. The effects of this breach, I think, are really insidious. In that, at the same time that TSA would like to persuade people that they can reasonably handle information about past travel patterns, about other types of information about individuals, and can utilize that information to make the process more selective and more focused on people as opposed to weapons, and at the same time protect it, that assertion is undercut by when we see these breaches of security that they can't even protect their own manuals.
So, in other words, then, the manual itself, I take it, you would agree with Patrick Smith and presumably with the TSA as well, that what was revealed probably wouldn't help a terrorist who was focused on getting the plane to fall out of the air.
There are a couple of things in there that are disturbing and probably would better off not being disclosed. But certainly what was disclosed doesn't provide any secret path to hijacking an airliner. Most of what was revealed confirms what is readily observable. And we do know that the 9/11 hijackers observed the security system, they tested it, they identified, and ultimately exploited its vulnerabilities, not simply in terms of the surprising end of the hijacking, which was to crash the airplanes instead of simply altering their destination, but also they exploited that system in order to get those weapons on board. They knew what they could do, and they succeeded 19 out of 19 times.
You said that a couple things in this manual that was released are disturbing to you. Is that something you want to talk about on the radio or not?
Probably not. I mean, the defenses are still there. So putting out information about how those defenses work, what some of those procedures are, what some of those technology limitations are in some of the technology, as I say, that's probably not useful to get out. It doesn't necessarily make the next hijacking particularly easy. I don't know that I would particularly be impressed by the argument that it's outdated. It's true that these procedures are constantly changing, but essentially those procedures that we're looking at today are the procedures that were in effect 20, 30 years ago.
Brian Jenkins, man who's been studying terrorism for as long as there has been focus on that in the United States. Back to Patrick Smith, our Ask the Pilot columnist for Salon.com, a pilot himself. Would you agree with Brian Jenkins that the most important thing that's happened here is that there might be a lack of confidence on the part of the people who are going to have to give up information if, in fact, the security system is changed to focus not so much on weapons and tactics but on the individuals who get on the planes?
I would very much agree with that. I think at heart this is an information issue, a privacy issue, and not the release of blueprints to give terrorists a new way to attack us or any of that kind of histrionic silliness. Meanwhile, the best course of action would be for TSA to apologize, to get its bureaucracy under control, to stop these sorts of things from happening, and also, in the meantime, overhaul its airport security approach. I think for several reasons, not the least of which is the traveling public's apparent eagerness to be subjugated, harassed, and humiliated, this isn't going to happen. But, maybe if nothing else, they can learn to exercise a little common sense. I think that maybe more than anything else is what's missing from the airport security theater, if I can use that word. If we're to believe that screeners are indeed well-trained professionals, why can't they handle the responsibility of making an occasional judgment call? Okay, maybe you have 4 ounces of gel in your infant's baby toy. Okay, go on ahead. Some on-the-spot decision-making that'll make travel easier for everybody.
Brian Jenkins, is the TSA trying at the moment to overhaul what it does and the way it does it?
It has been making incremental changes. It has been trying unsuccessfully to bring about a major shift in the philosophy. And here it has run into a lot of resistance. There are constitutional issues here. There are issues about what kind of data the government should have, about how it can use that. It is interesting that again, the traveling public is willing to give up a tremendous amount of information to credit card companies. Credit card companies know a great deal about the habits, purchasing preferences, and travel patterns of their individual customers. But they're uncomfortable with that same type of information being in the hands of a government agency. And so there has been resistance on the part of members of Congress to the implementation of what would be an essentially different philosophy. Now, my own view is we do have to move in that direction because, as Mr. Smith has correctly pointed out, we're moving, on average, 2 million passengers a day boarding airplanes, going through the screening process. Passenger loads are going up. the number of procedures being performed by the security screeners since 9/11 has increased, but the number of screeners is not increasing. So at some point, the system begins to break down. We simply cannot deal with growing volumes of passengers, a growing number of procedures, a growing amount of technology, with the same number of people. So we're going to have to change the way we do this.
Okay, if we do that, then when you say there's data that needs to be gathered, information that needs to be given up comparing to what the credit cards know about us, and I think we all know that the credit cards know an awful lot, what sort of information are you talking about, and how would it be used, and would there be complaints about profiling and that sort of thing if the philosophy were changed?
Well, there are always potential complaints about profiling, and particularly when people talk about profiling, they have in mind racial or ethnic profiling. And, of course, that would be not only inappropriate, but from a security standpoint, it would be utterly stupid. I mean, we don't have a profile for a hijacker. We've had young hijackers, old hijackers. We've had female terrorists, male terrorists. And so it's certainly not going to be profiled on the basis of race, ethnicity, or gender. But there is now a system in place that is a computer-assisted a passenger screening process, which looks at information that is readily available on the passenger's record about the purchase of the ticket, the destination, the routes, and so on. It turns out that has been useful in identifying, not so much identifying hijackers, but identifying people who you're not going to worry that much about. You're not going to particularly worry about the AARP group tour to Orlando, Florida, and you may know that from the passenger record. That can be expanded to past travel patterns, to other kinds of information, to confirmation of addresses, to connecting it to other readily available database systems, but it does mean connecting databases. And it's not the element of information that is objectionable. It is the connectivity and its use by a government agency that people find troublesome.
So do people really know enough to find it troublesome? Do you really think that they understand it in the way that you're describing it?
It's not that the average traveler necessarily knows that, but there are groups who appropriately and passionately dedicate themselves to civil liberties issues and certainly will make that known to members of Congress, who exercise a great deal of control. When I was on the White House Commission on Aviation Safety and Security, we created a panel of civil libertarians deliberately identified so that they would act as a kind of in-house critics to the measures that we were proposing.
Brian Jenkins, once again, advisor to the president of RAND, author of Will Terrorists Go Nuclear? We'll come back, talk with him, Patrick Smith, and others on a reporter's notebook. We're going to talk about American evangelists and gay bashing in Africa. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point to talk today about airport security, White House security, security in general in the aftermath of the breaches of security that we have seen in the last couple of weeks. We're going to come back and talk more about both the White House and the airports in a moment. But first, there's another issue, and that is that the president has ordered government agencies to be more transparent. Every agency is supposed to release now information from at least three databases that hasn't been made available before in order to provide for more openness in government. David Silverberg is founding editor of Homeland Security Today. That's a monthly publication for Homeland Security officials. He's also author of the book Congress for Dummies. David Silverberg, good to have you on our program.
It's a pleasure.
You can talk about Homeland Security for Dummies if you're talking to me anyway.
I've heard every joke regarding Congress and dummies.
I'm sure you have. Well, what about the issue of greater openness at a time when there might, as we've just heard pointed out, be an erosion of confidence on the part of the public with the ability of the government to protect secrets that ought to be protected?
Well, it's certainly a concern, and certainly this is the TSA manual is a security breach. And I want to draw a distinction between what happened at the White House, which I would consider a security lapse, as opposed to the manual release, which was a security breach. And this is not the only document that has leaked. Earlier in the year, there was an analysis of domestic potential terrorists from the extreme right wing of the political spectrum, and that got leaked and caused a big political furor.
That was from the Homeland Security Department as well.
That's right. That was from their analysis division. So, but when you consider the number of secrets that they're probably actually keeping, as opposed to these lapses and breaches, it's a fairly small proportion. That said, you know, any breach or any lapse is truly unacceptable.
How likely are we to see more breaches from people who work in the government, perhaps earnestly and responsibly, but really don't understand these enormously complex systems that they're dealing with? Brian Jenkins talked about the connectivity of these various systems as well.
Well, absolutely. But, you know, you have to realize you're dealing with a department that has 180,000 individuals in it. And it's very easy for somebody to hit the wrong send button and disseminate, you know, incorrect information. What makes it even more important is that our protection does rely on this department. It has to be 100% correct 100% of the time. And any small lapse, any major breach, obviously, reflects very, very badly on the Department of Homeland Security. And now, speaking politically, as we go into a congressional election year, you know, the opposition, the Republicans, and whatever other critics there are for the administration are going to be using these breaches as evidence of a failure on the part of the administration to keep us all safe.
In what way do you think that this will work politically? The Democrats have, I think, since Richard Nixon, been accused of being soft on security. Are you talking about that kind of political argument?
Well, yeah, I think you're going to see a lot of flim-flam. You're going to see a lot of charges that may not be based on anything as we go into the year. But, you know, for the administration, it wants to have successful security. Now, in defense of the Department of Homeland Security, it's in this very unenviable position where it's successful when absolutely nothing happens, and when anything happens, it's usually a failure on its part. There's a lot of effort being made on behalf of Homeland Security. There is a lot of incremental progress. There are a lot of processes at work, and there are a lot of vulnerabilities that have been closed. But that's not the stuff that grabs the headlines, and then you have something like this this breach with the TSA manual, which makes everybody look bad.
What do you mean about the difference between a breach and a lapse?
Well, for example, at the White House, this was clearly the misjudgment of one probably low-level Secret Service agent. My bet is it was somebody right out of training, somebody with little experience, who made a very poor judgment call and let these gatecrashers in. And then, you know, it wasn't picked up at subsequent layers of security, which is not good. However, you know, you talk to a former Secret Service agent like I did, and, you know, their criteria was the president ever in physical danger? That's the way the Secret Service judges its performance, and their conclusion was that he never was. So this is not a big deal. With the TSA manual, now you're talking about a system-wide procedural breach. And what I'll tell you, what really took my breath away was the fact that credentials and some credentials from very sensitive agencies were on this manual. That opens up the possibility of counterfeiting. And, you know, to change all those credentials for all those people or to make them somehow now secure is a tremendous amount of work because it takes a lot of work and a lot of effort to issue secure credentials in the first place. So the TSA breach was a big problem. That's a breach, and that's the kind of thing that's really bad.
So you think the Salahis went through the metal detectors and all of that kind of thing before they got in there, and is that why the president wasn't in danger?
Yeah, because they had gone through magnetometers, and there was never a physical threat to the president. Now, it showed awfully poor judgment, and believe me, White House dinners henceforth are going to be very, very tight. But it was not an existential threat to anybody. And the TSA thing, you know, in a way endangers the traveling public, because now even if the procedures were old, they were based on, you know, some kind of reality, and you can change procedures only so much. And it does provide a manual to people who might do wrong, and not just terrorists, you know, people who want to cut the line, people want to get through things. You know, it opens the door to a lot of mischief.
David Silberberg, founding editor of Homeland Security Today. So we come back to this question of the technology that is available now and the likelihood of its being breached, to use David Silberberg's term of art here, and the contrary effort to make government more open, more transparent, which the president now is putting into effect. Ari Schwartz is vice president and chief operating officer of the Center for Democracy and Technology. That's an internet watchdog. And Ari Schwartz, good to have you on our program.
Thank you, Warren.
What about this? Is there a contradiction here, and is it something that we ought to be worried about? You're in favor of more openness.
I am in favor of more openness, and we also push for greater privacy and security, and I don't think that those are at odds as much as they're often made out to be. This case with TSA, we really saw that redacted information was redacted incorrectly by the government employees.
And redacted means edited in this case.
Right, or blocked out incorrectly, and they just didn't follow the manual of how you're supposed to do that when you're posting it online. I do think we're probably going to see more of that because more information is going to be posted. However, and obviously the training has not happened correctly. We've seen this in other agencies as well where Social Security numbers have been posted or other information that could potentially harm individuals might be posted. But it's important to realize here that secrecy is not security, right? Keeping this information, saying we shouldn't post any information at all online because it might lead to security breaches is the wrong approach. The right approach is trying to figure out how we get information, the right information posted at the right time in the right place by the right people. And we're obviously not there yet. A lot of that is because the cybersecurity efforts that have been done inside of agencies have been so focused on compliance only. One thing that we know the administration is trying to move to is more performance-based approaches. What we've seen is where a mistake like this is made, a lot of attention is paid to trying to figure out how to get compliance to stop this kind of mistake from being made again, and some other mistake gets made, instead of trying to figure out how do we cut down on breaches altogether, how do we make sure that people that are posting information understand what information they should be posting and how they should be doing it in general.
The Bush administration took a lot of heat because it appeared that during the years that they were in charge, the backup position was don't give it out, rather than if there's any question. If you change that and the backup position is give it out, even if there is a question, does that lead, Ari Schwartz, to the possibility of more breaches just because everybody's attitude changes?
Well, there has to be a balance in both cases. I think you have to have the focus on security as you have this focus on privacy as you have the focus on openness. And so it's extremely important to have that balance. One thing that we've pushed for is the idea of getting more of strengthening the Privacy Act and strengthening the controls on the information, and also this emphasis on new kinds of cybersecurity techniques within the agencies at the same time that we promote posting of more information online so that we can hold the government accountable. I think that you don't get more security by in cases where TSA and DHS are less accountable as well. So how do you hold them more accountable? Having more information to the public helps us to do that. That's what you and reporters do as well, right, is to use information that you get from the government to try and figure out and to report on and hold the agency more accountable for securing us. So being open is part of security as well, and we have to take that into account. But we can't discount the fact that securing information as you post it online and making sure that that confidential information, that private information, and that information that can harm the security of the country does not get posted.
Ari Schwartz, again, Vice President, COO of the Center for Democracy and Technology. David Silberberg, back to you, founding editor, Homeland Security Today. Do you agree that, as we just heard from Ari Schwartz, secrecy is not security?
Well, secrecy is security to a degree. There's always problems on either end. There's a problem with transparency and releasing too much information that could reveal too many, well, in the case of TSA, too many procedures and so forth. On the other hand, there's the danger of too much secrecy where everything is a secret and then, you know, there's leaks and abuses get hidden and covered up. I don't know that there's any perfect system, and I don't know that we'll ever reach a system of perfection or a state of perfection. You have to release to the public what the public is entitled to know, and that won't harm the public. You have to keep secret what will, you know, secure the state and keep the people protected. And you know, you just walk that a fine line every day with every document, and there is no one size fits all, single panacea that solves the problem forever.
Ari Schwartz, what do you say to David Silberberg's comment earlier that this could pose a political problem for the president? And does he run that risk to the extent that he becomes known for opening up a government and making more information available?
I absolutely think that if you're moving towards openness and you don't take security and privacy seriously, they will be running a risk. They certainly have talked the talk on cybersecurity to try and get at some of these issues. We haven't seen, we're still waiting to see the action in the same way, and so we'll have to see how that pans out. I think they have some good ideas about how to do it in the space, but we have to see the action that follows it up, especially getting that down all the way to the level of the agencies where you have people who are in charge of posting this information making these mistakes. Again, there were the procedures were there in this case, and people didn't follow them. What happens?
Do you concede, then, that these more complex systems that are being used are more vulnerable to breaches? Ari Schwartz.
I don't think in this case, this is simply a PDF document that wasn't redacted correctly. Mm. It's not more complicated system. It's the more information. I mean, another case from 2 years ago during the Bush administration, you had a posting of where USDA, the Agriculture Department, posted contractors, their contractor number, and inside the contractor number was a Social Security number. Mm. Now, it was a mistake. It was actually against the law for violating the Privacy Act for the agency to keep to have that number that is a public number have a Social Security number in it, but it wasn't until it was actively posted online that we knew that they were violating this law. Again, there are mistakes made. That's a procedural issue, not something to do with the technology. We have to go and look at all of these documents and make sure that we have the processes in place to catch those kinds of things before things get posted.
Just want to clean up a couple of loose ends here. Let me go back to Brian Jenkins, with the who's now a senior advisor to RAND, a longtime student of these issues we're talking about. Are the credentials that were a part of the inadvertent release by the TSA or improper release by the TSA, depending on how you look at it, are those all going to have to be changed? Is that going to be expensive and time-consuming and difficult?
It will certainly be a distraction. I don't know whether they will change them all. We are already seeing problems with counterfeit credentials, law enforcement credentials, things of this sort. So it already was recognized as a problem. This will certainly complicate that problem, and to the extent that resources have to be diverted now to deal with it, that takes very, very precious resources away from other more useful things that could be done. So that says that this breach does have a cost attached to it. There is another cost, though, and again, I think a lot of these effects are insidious. Put aside the procedural issues of whether or not a document was redacted correctly. Put aside the broad philosophical issue of openness of government versus state secrets in a free society. And let's talk about security. Security comprises, in part, things that are real barriers, real procedures, real measures. But it also includes a great deal that is illusion, that is mystery. To the extent that we strip away that mystery from these systems, that we make them, that we expose every aspect of them, that has an insidious effect. To the extent that something like TSA or the Department of Homeland Security can be portrayed as being incompetent, that erodes security. I mean, we would like to both be incompetent, but just as important, we would like to have those responsible for security appear as competent, because that has a deterrent effect.
Patrick Smith, back to you, airline pilot, writer of the Ask the Pilot column. You had some pretty critical things to say about the TSA at the outset. My understanding is you feel that the airports are, in fact, the last line of defense, and that security, as far as air travel is concerned, ought to begin before that.
Well, exactly. I think TSA theoretically plays a useful role as a last line of defense, particularly with explosive screening. Bomb screening, behavioral profiling, hopefully at some point. But really, the nuts and bolts of keeping terrorists away from airplanes is something that goes on in the world of intelligence and law enforcement. It's the CIA, it's the FBI. It's not a screener on the concourse. Chances are, if a perpetrator has made it to that point, he or she already knows how to get past the last part of the system.
But Brian Jenkins, is that part of the illusion that makes it possible for people to get on the plane in the first place, even though they might have the lurking fear that a terrorist is on too?
Well, in terms of perceptions, I mean, the fact is that law enforcement, federal authorities, have uncovered since 9/11 30-some terrorist plots in the United States. Now, I would not assert that even if these plots had been undiscovered, that every one of them would have resulted in a serious terrorist attack, but they do give an indication that there are people who have intentions to carry out acts here. The fact that those attacks, those plots were uncovered, the fact that arrests were made, often involving painstaking intelligence work, does create a positive perception in terms of security that people who come together to conspire to carry out acts of terrorism will be identified and apprehended. That's a positive deterrent.
Okay, we're going to leave it at that. I want to thank you all for being on our program today. Brian Jenkins, again, an independent security expert, senior advisor to the president of RAND, most recent book, Will Terrorists Go Nuclear, and also a former member of the White House Commission on Aviation Safety and Security in both 1996 and 1997. Patrick Smith, airline pilot, writer, Ask the Pilot column for Salon.com, also has a book, Ask the Pilot, Everything You Need to Know About Air Travel. David Silberberg, founding editor of Homeland Security Today, also author of Congress for Dummies, and Ari Schwartz, Vice President, COO of the Center for Democracy and Technology, an internet watchdog and an advocate for government transparency. Good to have all of you on our program, and many thanks. Televangelists in the United States are broadcast in African countries, including Uganda. Pastor Rick Warren of the Purpose Driven Life is especially proud of his outreach. But that's also drawn him into the controversy over a proposal to make what's called aggravated homosexuality punishable by death in Uganda. Yesterday, Warren issued a video message to Ugandan church leaders condemning the anti-gay bill. We'll have more on that in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To The Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To The Point. In his video message to Ugandan church leaders, Rick Warren says, "It is not my role to interfere with the politics of other nations, but it is my role to speak out on moral issues." Here's what he says about the proposed law.
The potential law before your parliament is unjust, it's extreme, and it's unchristian toward homosexuals, requiring death penalty even in some cases. And if I'm reading the proposed bill correctly, this law would also imprison anyone convicted of homosexual practice.
Rick Warren went on to say, "I oppose the criminalization of homosexuality." Andrew Rice has lived in Uganda. He's written a book about it. He's also written about it in newspapers and magazines. The book is The Teeth May Smile, But the Heart Does Not Forget. Andrew Rice, good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, tell us a bit about the influence of pastors, including Rick Warren, in Uganda, and particularly with regard to issues such as homosexuality.
Well, the evangelical movement throughout Africa has made incredible inroads. And I think one thing that's important to stress at the outset is that it's not purely a case of a foreign import coming in. It's a grassroots movement, and many of the most popular evangelists in Africa are Africans themselves, or Ugandans themselves in Uganda. That said, there are devotional television shows that are aired on mainstream channels, and in fact, a broadcast channel that that shows just 24 hours a day shows Christian programming. And Rick Warren is an influential voice, though I have to stress, not the only influential voice. There are other evangelicals who have great followings there that that if they spoke out would also carry great weight with the Ugandan public.
So they're regarded as authorities not just by the public but also by church leaders in Africa?
Certainly. I mean, well, it depends on you know, which church leaders you're talking about. There's a great divide, of course, a battle going on really among the between the mainline churches, Catholicism, Anglicanism, in Uganda, and the evangelicals. But yes, they're looked at as with respect. I mean, the pastors in Uganda look at them as colleagues. They don't look at them necessarily as leaders.
What about the attitude toward homosexuality? Is that a foreign import, or is that to some extent also indigenous to Uganda?
Well, the attitude towards it, I think, is can be distinguished. I mean, there has always been, of course, homosexual activity. You know, there are ancient words for gay in African languages, so. But you nevertheless will hear people make the argument that it's a Western import, that it came with colonialism. So in a way, it's almost like an anti-imperial argument that they say, well, this is an aspect of Western decadence that's being brought here. I should stress that I don't believe that myself. This is just what they're saying. You know, the anti-gay upsurge in anti-gay sentiment has, in large part, I think, been a bit of a foreign import. It's there are many people. These ex-gay ministries are sort of making inroads there. There's this idea that homosexuality is a disease that can be cured, and in fact, that was the background of this Ugandan law.
Tell us about the law and the prospects in Uganda for the death penalty for people who have committed what's called aggravated homosexuality.
Well, I should stress that the law is tentative. It's a proposed law, and it's changing even as we speak. There were reports out of Uganda that I did not report this firsthand, but I've read that the government has suggested that it may drop the death penalty provision from the bill that's garnered so much controversy. I should say, though, that the death penalty provision is only one quite objectionable aspect of the bill. Life imprisonment is the minimum punishment for anyone convicted of having gay sex under the bill.
Minimum punishment.
Right. So, in fact, it's extraordinarily retributive, even with the death penalty dropped from it. My suspicion, however, is that this bill will probably not pass the parliament, and if passed, will not be enforced, simply because the government's highly dependent on tourist income as a major source of income in Uganda, and second of all, highly dependent on foreign aid. And some countries, I think even Sweden has said that they're going to cut off foreign aid if this bill is passed. I'm sure other countries will make similar indications, and I think that will get the Ugandan government's attention.
We don't have a lot of time left, but I take it that homosexual bashing is convenient for politicians in Uganda, as it has been in other places around the world.
Yes, I mean, I think that it's a way for Ugandan politicians, I think, to show their religious bona fides by bashing gay people. There's a gay community in Uganda, but it is very small. Well, it's very secretive. It's hard to know how large it is because homosexuality is already outlawed. This bill would only toughen the penalties for it.
What about the Western decadence theme? Is that something that the evangelicals hit pretty hard?
Yes. I mean, one thing that you often hear, I mean, one underreported aspect of all of this is that oftentimes the American evangelicals who go to places like Uganda are preaching a message that, in fact, Africa is a sort of haven of conservative Christian values, whereas the United States has fallen into decadence. And this is one reason that that the evangelical movement, I think, has taken off in Africa, is because in a way it's the evangelicals are quite complimentary of Africa and have a real love for the place, which I don't think should be disparaged either. I mean, I think
sure.
that evangelicals do great things in Africa, and this just doesn't happen to be one of them.
Andrew Rice, again, formerly resident in Uganda, author of The Teeth May Smile, But the Heart Does Not Forget. Really good to have you on our program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Producers of To the Point, Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Andrea Brody, Katie Cooper, Sonia Geis, Gary Scott, Technical Director Mike Newport, Managing Producer Cameron Radziner. Special thanks to Courtney Fielding and Julia Flutes. Thanks to the John Coltrane family. You can email us or share your thoughts on our comment page, kcrw.com/To the Point. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point. Produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.